现在订阅鸿蒙会英语，不论找工作、升学或英检，表现更棒。快上
studioclassroom.com。
现在请收听教学节目。
Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. Dinosaur bones or after-school programs. Hi friends, welcome to Advanced Studio Classroom. I'm Rebecca, and today is February 20th. Yesterday we started a fascinating discussion of who owns treasures like dinosaur bones. Should the public own it, or should people who can afford it buy it and just keep it for themselves? Today we'll continue this fascinating topic. First, I'd like to invite John to the program.
All right. I love talking about dinosaurs in general, but I really am interested in collections of artifacts. So I'm excited to talk about this with you all listeners today.
Yes. John, I have a question. Yesterday we went through some really interesting ideas, and we also went through quite a few words. Do you have one word or thought in particular from yesterday that you think is worth going over one more time?
Okay, well, we talked about a lot of things when it came to private collections. So that would be one word, you're having a collection. But the phrase that stuck out to me was this thing called trophy fatigue, where someone has bought something very beautiful. It is their trophy, their prized possession, and eventually they get tired of it or tired of showing it, and they give it away. Here, we have the idea of rich people giving away incredibly valuable artifacts to museums.
Yes, trophy fatigue. That's a really interesting. We really use the word trophy a lot to talk about things that you can show off. Mm-hmm. Like another phrase in the past that was popular, I hope it's no longer popular, trophy wife.
Oh yeah, that's right.
You know, like sometimes, usually some wealthy or successful man, he has a usually much younger wife, and we call it the trophy wife because she's the one you can show off at your parties because, like, she's young and beautiful and makes you look younger. You know, in the past, we've had words like that. So this is interesting. Trophy fatigue. We also like to welcome Peter to the program. Peter, welcome.
Hello, Rebecca. Hi, everyone. Good to be here.
Peter, we've been embarking on a really interesting journey about who owns what. Is there any idea or concept from yesterday or word that you particularly like that you'd like to share with our audience?
Yeah, I was thinking yesterday, we talked about how there is this basic debate about whether artifacts like this dinosaur skeleton should simply belong in the private possession of whoever has the most money to pay for them, or if there is some kind of unwritten obligation, unwritten agreement that such objects like this should be in a public place where people can view them. And a side note for this that the author mentions yesterday is if they're in museums, then should they be in the museum in the country from which the item came, from which in this case the dinosaur was found? Or we mentioned also the example of Egypt and how there's a great museum in Britain, the British Museum, which has these wonderful Egyptian artifacts. But should they be in the British Museum, or should they be in a museum in Egypt? And I like that idea, even though it isn't really the idea that the writer is focusing on here, but I like that idea because if you think about it, the idea of, you know, keeping dinosaur bones in a museum in the country where they were found, or Egyptian artifacts in Egypt, is almost like keeping the dinosaur bones with the person who can pay the most for them. Mm. Because there's a benefit to having things from Egypt that people in Britain can view, or people somewhere else. That's the basic benefit of a museum, is that it is in a public place where people from all over can see it, instead of everybody just going to John's house because he's got this great dinosaur. And so in a way, there's a metaphorical level to this idea of which museum it should be in, if they should be in museums, because then if all the ancient Egyptian stuff is in Egypt, that means that's the only place we can go see it now. We can't see it in London. We can't see it in Boston, or Tokyo or wherever. We all have to go to Egypt to see the ancient Egyptian things. And in a way, that's like having to go to Ken Griffin or whoever this billionaire is who bought the dinosaur. It's almost like having to go only to his house to see the dinosaur.
That's actually a really interesting point. I never thought of it from that perspective. I've been thinking on the opposite end, like perspective is, can the museums of the bones or dinosaur bones home country actually afford to keep the dinosaur bones?
That's because another question.
I think if you have a dinosaur skeleton, perhaps it needs to be in the perfect condition. Perhaps you need the room temperature has to be at a specific temperature. Perhaps the humidity of the room has to be at a specific humidity. So there are so many factors, which means that some treasures are really expensive to upkeep.
Yes.
And then the home countries, can they actually afford it? Or there are some countries, for example, like Iraq, they've gone through many, many wars. And right. during a time of war, you know, people rob museums.
Yes.
That's just what human nature does. Like we do, like when you're poor, you'll rob anything. And they rob the museum. So if you keep the stuff in their home country, and that country is not a safe country, then nobody gets to enjoy it.
Right.
Not even the people of that country.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it will be robbed, it will be destroyed, just because it's located in a very unsafe place. So that is such an interesting conversation. I hope we can do that conversation another day when we talk about, you know, talk more about museum rights and the origin of these treasures. But today we need to move on to the question of museums, especially public museums. How should they spend their money? So let's get into our first reading where we talk about some of the things that museums should spend or could spend their money on. So let's go into our first reading.
Better uses for money. Perhaps museums have better things to spend their money on than fossils. In Columbus, Ohio, where COSAI is located, our students score below 25% in mathematics proficiency at despondent levels of 16% in elementary school, 13% in middle school, and 10% in high school. Similar numbers can be found in urban and rural communities throughout the nation. Our district only spends $9 million on instruction. That is 20% of what APEX cost. If I had $45 million to bring the Stegosaurus to my city, would I have spent it on a dinosaur, as majestic and inspiring as it is, when I could use that money to create outreach programs to inspire young people about what science can mean to them? I also need to ask whether in today's world, where precision 3D modeling can create extremely accurate replicas of fossils in art, a replica of APEX is an equally stunning and inspiring way to introduce children and adults to the history of our planet. It certainly is a more economically sane approach, one that would allow their available museum funds to have a more profound impact on education and our shared future.
Well, should museums spend all their money or a lot of their money on fossils? Let's talk about Columbus, Ohio. And why Columbus? This is where the writer, the author here, Frederick Bertley, this is where his museum is located. This is his museum, the acronym COSAI, is located in Columbus. John, can you tell us a little bit about the students in Columbus?
Okay, and to set the stage, the idea of a museum, at least to Frederick Bertley, seems to be education. So a museum is a place that's for education. People might think about museums differently, and honestly, I haven't thought too deeply about why we have museums. Mm. But he mentions in Columbus, Ohio, where COSAI is located, our students score below 25% in mathematics proficiency. Sorry to you folks listening from places where math scores are a lot higher. It sounds really low. And he calls that despondent levels. If something is despondent, it means it's hopeless and you've lost enthusiasm. You feel like you're in a difficult situation. So sometimes we use this word abysmal, like, oh, that was an abysmal score. But Columbus, Ohio, certainly not the math capital of the world.
Yes. And then he goes on And from 25%, he goes on, it's even worse. 16% for elementary school, 13% in middle school, and 10% in high school. Mm. So basically, it means most of the students in Columbus, their math scores are really, really below average.
Right.
Like, they're not at the level that kids of a similar age should be. So this is actually, you know, quite disturbing. And he goes on to say, this is not just unique for Columbus, Ohio. This is in many places around the U.S. where there are museums. There are many kids in this kind of situation. Now, let's talk about how much money Columbus or their district is spending on education.
Right. Well, it tells us in the next line that our district there in Columbus spends only $9 million on instruction, which, as he notes, is 20% of what that single dinosaur cost that we read yesterday, the apex dinosaur, which which was gaveled down at auction at $45 million. So it is striking, the difference between how much a community spends on instruction and how much a billionaire is willing to spend on a dinosaur skeleton.
Yes, and so the question he asks is, should we spend this money on dinosaur bones?
Right.
When I could be using the same money to bring education and have more programs for kids and teens, you know, like make many, many, many programs actually,
right,
with the same amount of money. So here he poses the questions. When I could use that money to create outreach programs to inspire young people about what science can mean to them,
yeah,
you know, which one is more worth it? And then we go on to another really interesting idea about 3D printing. John,
right,
have you ever done 3D printing?
Ooh, I don't. No, I certainly have never owned a 3D printer, and I don't know if I've ever, like, ordered a custom 3D printed piece of equipment or... No, I have not.
But they're, like, 3D printing is quite amazing. Actually, we do have a store down the street that I believe has 3D printing.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's still open, but I walked past there a while ago and there was a 3D printing shop. These days, people can print anything. You can even print a house.
You can. You can print the spaceship, and you can certainly print dinosaur bones. So the question is, A, is it fine to have a artificial dinosaur bone replica in your museum? And B, wouldn't it be a lot cheaper? So he makes a really interesting point here. I can't help but think that there's kind of this question in museums about between experience and information, right?
Yes.
Like, we want people to experience the art. We want them to experience the bones. That's kind of the point of the museum. But if you can change the experience just a little bit and focus more on the information, isn't that better, you know, to do a outreach program rather than to say, oh, I had the experience of seeing the authentic stegosaur bone. Like, what is important in education? Because as we know in education, we always have to make choices, right?
Yes.
Education is very resource intensive. It's very time intensive, and you have to always decide, do I do this or do I do this other option? And spending $45 million on a stegosaurus bone really is a hard sell for an educator.
It really is, especially because in the education sphere, it's also one of the things where the return on investment is quite low. You
yes.
don't make your money back right away.
Right.
Because in education, we're all preparing for the future. Like, we invest in children because we believe that one day they will grow up to be good citizens who can contribute to a better world.
Right.
But it's a very, very long journey where you don't make your money back quickly. So that's, education is not a sector where a lot of people invest tons of money to make a quick return, I think.
Well, I'm wondering here whether the author has stumbled upon the possible solution to the issue, because with 3D printing, or 3D modeling, as he calls it here, precision 3D modeling, if it can create a very extremely accurate replica of the apex dinosaur, for example, then it's... Maybe we can have it both ways. Maybe the billionaire can have his $45 million actual stegosaurus skeleton, and a museum, for however much it costs, I assume less than $45 million, can get the 3D modeling version of it, and then both sides are happy.
And I think that happens as well. You know, many dinosaur skeletons are actually partial. I think you're absolutely right, Peter. A lot of skeletons weren't complete, And so they do have replica bones filling them in. You know, it's very rare to find a full rib cage of a dinosaur that's been eaten and covered with mud for who knows how long. And so, you know, we do this already. But the question is, at what point shouldn't we do that? And he uses a great phrase. He says, it certainly is more economically sane. It's a more economically sane approach. I like how he brings just sanity into the equation, don't you?
Mm. So when somebody is sane, they're not crazy, right?
They're not an obsessive.
They're not obsessive. They're not crazy. They're level-headed.
Yes.
Like they're practical. So like from sane, the opposite of sane is insane. Right? The price is insane. The amount being charged for something is just crazy. And we can say the price for these dinosaur bones, really, like for Apex, it seems insane. $45 million for dinosaur bones, like for something that's already passed away. It's not even a live dinosaur. It's dinosaur skeleton. We're paying $45 million US for it.
Yeah.
So this does seem like a more sane approach.
Yeah.
Just do the 3D printing, which I think would not cost over $1,000 US,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah. But of course, there will always be the desire for the real thing.
Yes. Of course. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, because we want to be able to show off, well, for a number of reasons.
It's the same reason that tickets to the theater cost more than tickets to the movies.
Mm.
We want to be in the presence of actual human beings telling us a story rather than just see pictures of them. We'll settle for the pictures if that's what our budget allows, but if we had the price, we'd like to see Hugh Jackman in person on stage.
Yeah. It's true, so I guess it depends on how much you can afford. Well, on that note, let's continue into our second reading, and we'll talk about the role of institutions like museums. So let's continue on our next reading.
The role of institutions. At the same time, I have a message for my colleagues in the museum world and in academia who believe that our shared cultural heritage should be immediately and forever accessible. If that is your mission, then move faster and abandon your layered bureaucracy when opportunities like Apex present themselves. Cultural institutions should be partnering more with private donors, creating a new era of co-bidding, ultimately affording a new, wider aperture for showing the prize and doing research around it. The scientists tell us Apex had a touch of arthritis before he became preserved forever. Let us elevate our discussion beyond the fossilized zero-sum game of the past and create a new era wherein society can creatively reconcile the desires of the wealthy and the needs of the masses.
So we continue. So now we've talked about how to use museum money. And then the author, Mr. Bertley, he wants to continue talking to the other museum directors and those people, the professors, like the people in academia. So he says, I have a message for my colleagues in the museum world and in academia. And when we talk about academia, we are just talking about what, Peter?
When we talk about academia, we're talking basically about colleges, universities, anything that has to deal with academics. And in that sense, you might think, well, maybe we're talking about schools for children. But usually when we use that word academia, we're talking about college level or graduate school level education.
Yeah, and sometimes the sciences, it's where the sciences kind of begin. You know, the funding in the universities or professors and PhD students that are doing the research. And it's often a very hard world to break into. It's very high level.
Yeah, sometimes we even have a term we use for describing academia. We use the term ivory tower.
Mm, yes.
So ivory tower is like in the fairy tale. I think there's one fairy tale where the princess, she's in a very, very, very high tower. And an ivory tower is a tower that is very, very, very high. And we think of these researchers or these professors, you know, these PhD students, they are working hard and studying, but they are high up in their tower and they are far away from normal life. That's not always true, but that's kind of like the stereotype of academia, ivory tower. They are up in a high tower, a lofty high tower.
And kind of removed from the interests of the world below.
Yes.
And he says, I have a message for my colleagues in the museum world and in academia. And then he focuses on the people who believe that our shared cultural heritage should be immediately and forever accessible. So he's saying, hey, if you think that artifacts from history should be accessible, which means should be able to be seen by regular people, then if that is your mission, he says, move fast and abandon something. This is really interesting.
I love this. He says, abandon your layered bureaucracy. Bureaucracy. This is a great word. We think of bureaucracy when we think of many, many levels, like many levels, for example, in government or sometimes at the university. To get approval to do something, you have to get many different departments to stamp your paper. So when we talk about bureaucracy, we're talking about all these different levels, whether it's government or in the academic world where you have to get approval. But the problem of bureaucracy, and sometimes we even use the term red tape. Like red tape,
yes,
is just all the barriers that you have to get through to get to the next level. And he talks about the bureaucracy and he says that you need to be able to get through the bureaucracy faster because sometimes opportunity comes, but you have so many barriers, so many levels, you have to get stamps, you have to get approval, that by the time you finish all your stamping, the opportunity is gone. Right, Peter?
Yeah. Right, right. And so he says, basically that cultural institutions, those in academia, should be, proactive. They should be partnering more with private donors, like Ken Griffin, the guy with the apex skeleton, and creating a new era of co-bidding, he says, which I presume means in which the cost of, say, dinosaur bones is shared by private individuals and public institutions for the, you know, ultimate goal of having the public able to see it. Or as he puts it in the next line there, affording a new wider aperture for showing the prize, the dinosaur bones, and doing research around it. Interesting use of the word aperture there. Aperture, normally just something in a camera, meaning the adjustable opening in a camera that limits or controls the amount of light that passes through for the level of exposure that you're looking for when you take a picture. But in this case, he's using it figuratively to mean like an opportunity, or what we sometimes call a window of opportunity. Opportunity, which is what an aperture is. It's like a little window, and you can open it this much if you want this much air, or just this much if you want less air. And so he's saying that if cultural institutions can partner with the private wealthy donors, then that can widen the aperture for the public to see the prize and also for research to be done around it. So again, both parties can benefit from this.
Yes, he's trying to find a way where both parties contribute. And it might not be, the dinosaur bones don't always have to be in some billionaire's home. Perhaps it can be in the billionaire's home 6 months of the year, and then you run an exhibition in the museum where the billionaire lets you have the dinosaur skeleton for another 6 months to show the public, and then when it's Christmas season or the time the billionaire likes to have his parties, then we ship back the dinosaur bones back to the billionaire's home. Perhaps there's a middle road. Yes, John?
Well, I've seen this happen while working in Los Angeles as a struggling artist. I worked for a company called Black Tie Event Services. You know, so I was a waiter at parties and fundraisers, things like the Oscars. And I'll tell you what happened a lot. Wealthy institutions or private folks, movie stars that had a new product, they often had a party or a fundraising event in a museum, because museums are such wonderful staging grounds for fundraising events. They're beautiful. They're already artistically designed. There's a sense of culture. There's private collections. And so you get this win-win. You get the rich people who get to show off their prize, their trophy, and you get the benefit of the institution being able to carry on doing research, and it does become a win-win. He uses this phrase, a zero-sum game, before, and a zero-sum game, this is a term in like a competitive game, right?
Yes, in the military. I think a lot of times we use zero-sum game in military terms, like for example during the Cold War. Like perhaps you have two sides, like if one side gets 1 point, then oh no, I can't even let them get 1 point, because if they get 1 point, that means I'm like losing. So in a zero-sum game, like one side gets gain anything, it means I'm at a loss. Mm. And that's the exact opposite of what you were talking about, because you were talking about a win-win situation.
Yes.
And a win-win situation is the exact opposite of a zero-sum game. If Peter gets 1 point, poor Rebecca has lost 1 point. So that's a very competitive and maybe a dysfunctional
right. And when you think about it, most sports games are not zero-sum games. You know, in a baseball game, the score will be this team had 10 and that team had 8.
Right.
That means the team with 10 wins, but a zero-sum game means one person has 100%, the other side has 0%. And that's the only way it can be. Either one side is completely up and the other side completely down, or vice versa. There's no middle ground of any kind.
Yeah, so he's trying to be a bridge. He's trying to strike a middle ground. And then there's another middle ground word we should learn to end today's program. John, we have the word reconcile.
It's such a beautiful word. Reconcile means to make peace or find a way that two situations that are two parties that are opposed can turn to each other and agree. And these two parties are the wealthy and then the masses. Masses is short for masses of people, but it's a term that often means the lower class people in all their numbers versus the few wealthy.
And the middle class too. I don't think the masses is necessarily just the poor people.
But we don't include the wealthy people in
certainly
the masses.
But the wealthy
the
are never thought of in the masses, right.
Yeah. And really we're talking about questions of the human heart. We often hate people that we perceive as getting something that we don't. It comes down to sin and envy. But at the end of the day, having a heart of reconciliation is how you create beautiful things.
Yes, that's really beautiful ending. And I hope there are more win-win solutions so that us, the masses, we can benefit, but at the same time, the wealthy people who can afford these treasures, they can also figure out a way that they can also be happy. I think there is a lot of middle ground that can be found. There's always middle ground that can be found if you're willing to look for it and if you don't see the world in terms of a zero-sum game. So on that note, we need to end today's program. I'm Rebecca.
I'm John.
I'm Peter.
Saying goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
See you next time.